Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. How to be an observer and non-judgmental. It literally is just practice. What the mind does, like the heart loves, as I was saying, the heart loves. What the mind does is the mind analyzes, and the mind judges, and the mind discriminates. From a neurological standpoint, a scientific standpoint, the neurons in our brain actually fire with newness. So if you show, for example, a picture of the same face to someone, our neurons will fire for a little while, but slowly they'll stop firing. There's nothing new about it. If it doesn't move, a new face will get put there, suddenly all the neurons fire again. We are biologically programmed to newness, means to difference. What is newness? Newness is, this moment is giving me something different than the moment before. If it's all the same, my brain literally, even though my eyes may be open while I'm staring at it, my brain literally shuts off. It realizes I can take a rest, there's no new information coming in, and it shuts, not completely off obviously, but it goes down. And this is important because since the mind functions only in newness, it is going to keep looking for things that are new, that are different, to analyze, to think about. So if we try to do meditation from the mind, you can't. Like you can't do geometry from the heart, you can't do meditation from the mind. The mind is founded upon the principle of being separate from something and looking at it from a place outside. I can look at a math problem. I can look at two different people and see where one ends and the other begins. Differences, separation, distinction. This is not the same dinner as last night. I can look at it. Looks different. Mom, what did you do? Spinach looks funny, right? The mind is able to do this. So the minute we want to do something other than that, I don't want to analyze, I don't want to judge, I don't want to be off in my thoughts, I want to be just still in the witness, I have to move out of the normal activity of my mind. And this is what actually all of the meditation practices that we've been given are for. They give the mind first one thing to do. So they take the mind from being in 1,000 places and they put it in one. A mantra. One image of the divine, one candle flame, one word of God's name, whatever you choose. Each of them serves the same purpose in that it pulls your mind from all the other places it is, all the judgments, all the analyses, all the lists, all the complaints, all the planning, all the regretting. Pulls it into one thing. In that one thing then, if the mind can get really immersed fully into the mantra, then what ends up happening, or into the image or into the word, the thinking part of the brain stops. And when that happens is when we're able to access the ability to just watch, because then I'm not in my brain. I'm able to literally take a step back and watch. But it does take practice. It takes practice finding, okay, so my eyes are closed, I'm chanting my mantra, where is that witness? And for me, it's on a personal level, it's literally a visual and almost a sensory experience of feeling myself step back. And in my own mind, feeling my awareness just go like that, and then turn around and watch the rest. I happen to be a very visual person, so for me, there's a visual imagery of stepping back and then seeing my mind, seeing myself. But it doesn't have to be like that. It can be anyway. But just give yourself that practice of first bringing the mind into one thing upon which you're meditating, and allow the mind to really just merge into that. So there's no up and down, there's no here and there, it's just merged. And in that moment, allow your consciousness to just take a step back and turn around and watch the mind merged into the mantra. Watch the mind chanting the mantra. Watch the mind merged with the breath. And it'll happen. It'll absolutely happen. It's just not going to happen immediately. By the grace of the guru, by the grace of the divine, we can have, even with no meditation experience, even with no sadhana, you can absolutely be touched and have an incredibly deep and powerful spiritual experience. But with the witness specifically, what I have found is that actually takes practice. Simply because it's like getting to know a part of you that you're not used to activating. It's like a new muscle in the body that takes a little while in the beginning to kind of find, okay, how do I get there? But once you do, it becomes much, much easier. And then you're able to sit there and watch the rest. And the witness doesn't judge. So once you've been able to do that, the judgment itself ceases. If you find yourself judging, you know you've gotten out of the witness and you're back in the mind. And so it's just about stepping back again. And the breath, lastly, the breath, regardless of what technique you use, the breath is a very, very, very powerful tool. So if you're chanting a mantra, if you're chanting a name of God or several names of God, if you're looking at an image, whatever you're doing, try to add the breath in there as well. The lower, the slower, and the deeper the breath is, when I say lower, I mean physically lower, like instead of being up here, it's down here. The lower the breath, the more it anchors and grounds you. And the more it stills the mind. Whenever the mind is frazzled, your breath is very shallow. And so the breath is a fantastic tool and ally also in stilling the mind.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me.
Why is it that we make people, events, and or circumstances outside of ourselves responsible for how we feel? Well, we all do this. It's your fault I'm angry. You've made me mad. You are the problem in my life. You are the reason I'm not peaceful. Or the flip side of it, you have to do this for me. Now, there's many reasons that we do it. One is very simply, it's how we were raised. Most of our parents did it. How many people here ever came home from school with a not very good mark on a report card or an exam and watched mom or dad's face just fall? Right? We all have it happen. And what we learn at a young age is, I am responsible for how mom and dad feel. Look at that. Mom was happy. I showed her my report card. Mom is no longer happy. What does that mean? I am the one who is responsible for mom's mood. And they tell us also, you make me so angry. Look at this. You know, you've ruined mom's night. Wait till your dad gets home. Dad's going to be so angry. Dad works so hard all day long for you. Now dad's going to come home and be so upset. Now, it's really important when we give these examples to realize we're not blaming parents. Parents all are doing the very best they can. The very best they can. But anybody in this room who's over the age of, say, 28 or 30, you look back on you when you were in your mid-20s, or you look at people in their mid-20s today, and you think, my God, they're babies. But that's the age that most of our parents were when we were born. And so as a child, it feels like they're so old, you know, that they're all powerful, they know everything, they can do everything. But of course, in retrospect, we realize, my God, they were babies, they were kids, they were doing the best they could. And really all they wanted was, you should clean your room, you should do well in school, you should be a sincere student. And the way that they taught you was the way they were taught, which is, dad's going to be really upset. But what we learn is much deeper than study hard in school. What we learn is, I am responsible for how my parents feel. I'm responsible for mom's happiness. Oh, mom's going to be so happy I got an A. Mom's going to be so sad I failed. I am responsible. And so if we learn this from childhood, that for our happiness is dependent on what people around us do. Then, of course, it gets reinforced by the media. Now, my goal is, you should buy my purses. Otherwise, I'm going to go out of business. If I'm a business person, what I need is to convince you to buy my purse. But if I want my business to do well, I need to convince you that there is something lacking in your life that my purse is going to solve. And this is true whether it's purses, whether it's shoes, whether it's cars, whether it's mobiles, because we all have one. We buy new things because what we've learned is that's what's going to make me happy, right? Shopping therapy. Horrible day. Oh my God, I'm so stressed. Let's go shopping. We're trained. We're trained. Every TV commercial we see, every advertisement in a magazine, all of the, on the internet, what is it plastered with? People who look much happier than we feel, who look much healthier than we are, who are much prettier or more handsome than we think we are, using an item that if we just would buy, we too could be that happy. And because we're so busy and most of what we do on autopilot, we're not actually scrutinizing it. When I say it like this, it sounds ridiculous. But this is how the world works. This is how all of these companies stay in business. I'm feeling down. I'm flipping through a magazine. I see a picture of a woman who looks much more beautiful than I feel, with a beautiful family around her. And on her shoulder, she has this purse. And then, of course, there's going to be some slogan that goes with it. Like, you know, recognize the joy in life, or treat yourself to luxury, or you deserve it, or, you know, whatever it is. And the message goes in, and the next time I need shopping therapy, I'm going to go and buy that purse. So, in addition to selling purses, something much deeper and something much more across the boardly insidious is happening. Which is, we are getting the message, not just I need that purse, but I need something outside of me in order to feel happy, in order to feel complete, in order to make my life better. Because all of the marketers use that tool. Now that's business. It's business as usual. It's marketing. If I did a commercial for the purse in which I said, you know, this is a great purse, but the one you have is probably pretty good too. I wouldn't sell very many purses. This purse is very good if you like black, if you need something that big. I wouldn't sell very many purses. I've got to first convince you something is lacking in your life. And this purse will fill it. And even if you don't, and this is the really sad part, even if you don't buy that purse, you buy the message. And so every time we flip through a magazine, every time we watch TV with commercials, every time we see online advertisements, regardless of whether we actually buy the items or not, we buy the message, which is, I'm not quite right. This one's happier than I am. This one's prettier than I am. This one's healthier than I am. This one's got, you know, much nicer legs than I do. And if I just wore those yoga pants, maybe my legs would look like that. And this one's got a better family than I do. This one takes nicer vacations than I do. And these are the ads. And so our whole life is spent believing that something outside of us, first we learn it at home, then we learn it through marketing, something outside of us is responsible for how I feel. But what that does is, first of all, obviously it makes us waste a whole bunch of money on shopping therapy that doesn't work. But it takes the power away from us. And it misdirects us away from actually what gives me happiness. Actually what the answer to my happiness is. You cannot simultaneously run in two directions. And so if I'm looking outside for the answer, I cannot be looking inside. So the more I'm directing at you, you're my problem. If you just would treat me better, if you just would listen to me, if you just would do what I want, if you just would whatever. Whether it's our family members, whether it's our friends, whether it's our employees or employers. I've disempowered myself. I said, I have no ability to be happy unless you do what I want you to do. I have no ability to be in peace unless you change that behavior. Well, that's really disempowering. And this is where we need to turn inward and to realize, actually, my happiness and my peace comes only from within me. And the way that you know this is, anytime we're in a group, say five people, 10 people, whatever it is, somebody says something, somebody does something, somebody looks at us in a certain way. Doesn't bother anybody else. But we walk out of that situation really angry. But the other people are fine. Which makes us realize it's not about what somebody said or did. It's about how I react to what somebody said or did. And then we go home and we sulk. And we're miserable. There's a beautiful quotation, I don't know who said it, but I love it, which is, if you're miserable in a room alone, chances are you are the cause. Right? If you're miserable in a room alone, chances are you are the cause. But we sit in our rooms alone, blaming others for our misery. They may have said something, they may have done something. But that's over. If I've carried the misery into this moment, I've carried it with me. I could go stand in front of that air conditioner for a while and feel the cold air. But if when I get three rooms away, I'm still cold, you can be pretty sure that I've carried that air conditioner with me. Because it was only here. But if it's still with me there, it means I'm the one who's picked it up and carried it with me. And this is where the spiritual teaching is always about. Connect within. You are the source. People can do whatever people are going to do. They've got their own karmic package that they've come into this world with. But we cannot hand them the keys to our peace and our happiness. Because that only comes from within. And the answer to that, of course, is just our spiritual practice, our yoga, our meditation. And that's the source of it. And that's where you see, I mean, I've witnessed this in my own life, in the contrast between coming from a world in which people had so much, but didn't feel satisfied. There was always something that was lacking. Not necessarily a physical possession, but somebody needed to treat them a different way. Somebody needed to talk differently. They needed something from other people. It's my husband, it's my kids, it's my maid, it's my employees, it's this, it's that. Into a world in India where people have so little. But there's so much more of a deep sense of happiness. So much more of a deep sense of joy and peace. And so I watched right before my eyes the contrast between here, there's so much, but there's still a sense of emptiness. And here, there's so little, but there's such a sense of fullness. But lastly, it takes a little bit of just reminding ourselves over and over again, because we're so quick. It becomes a habit. I was so peaceful, and then you came in the room. You're my problem. Well, no, you just walked into the room. You didn't reach into my heart and grab my peace and steal it out. You just walked in the room. Maybe you got a glass of water. Maybe you said something. If I ruined my peace based on the fact that you walked into the room, well, that's my doing, not your doing. I'm the one who's done that. And for us to just constantly re-remind ourselves and to check our vocabulary, rather than saying, I am angry. It's just a little semantic thing, but it hits home very, very deeply. Rather than saying, I am angry, can we learn to say, I have chosen to express anger in this moment. I have chosen to express anger, or I have chosen to feel anger in this moment. Either way, whether I'm expressing it or just feeling it. I've chosen to do this. Like you say, I've chosen, you know, potatoes or toast with my breakfast. Which do you want? It's up to you. You have a choice. But then also give yourselves credit for the other way. When you don't choose anger, remind yourselves, I've chosen to be peaceful in this moment. Or more shortly and succinctly, I choose peace. I choose love. You can do whatever you're going to do. But for me to hand my peace, hand my joy over to you is ridiculous. But it's a choice I make. And we have the choice to stop doing that. To literally unhook our emotions from other people's actions and words. And that's all it is. We've literally just said, all right, here, hold on to my peace for me. But in order to hold on to it, you got to jump this way and dance that way and cook that way and speak to me that way. And if you stop jumping or stop dancing or stop cooking or stop speaking, well, my peace starts to fall. And that's what we've done. But most of us think the answer is to keep this one dancing and singing and cooking and doing all this for us in the way that I need so my peace level stays high. But if instead I just pull the hook out of her, well, then she can dance or sing or cook or not cook or whatever she wants to do. Because the hook of my peace is back with me, not with her. And it's a much more successful way to manage your inner state than by trying to get every single person into whom you have hooked your well-being to dance and to sing and to cook and to speak and to do according to the way you want them to. And then we hold it and manage it. And that's really ultimately what a spiritual life is about. It's not that it has to be this form of God or that form of God or this form of prayer or that form of prayer, but just I connect so deeply with the self that I don't have hooks in other people. Rather, I try to help other people because I don't need you to act in a certain way for me, so I'm able to see you and to say, God, you know, she used to dance a lot. She doesn't dance anymore. And rather than me needing her to dance because my happiness level, I'm able then to reach out with compassion and to say, huh, is there a reason? A reason you're not dancing? Can I help you? Shall we dance? But I don't have any agenda with it. And so I'm really able to then be there with and for others in a way that I'm not when I need you to be in a certain way.
This is OTRFM, part of the iOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times. Co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth Radio is conscious living for your soul, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Mike Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation.
You've taken sannyas. What does that mean? What does the orange mean? And then the second part of the question has to do with gurus and how do we explain to our friends, you know, living abroad, that we have a guru. What does that mean, really, in a way that, I mean, we know what it means inside of us, but what does it mean in a way that we can share with our friends? Sannyas is actually a very literal, very specific rite of passage and initiation. The vows of sannyas are very much like vows of renunciation in any tradition. So it's the equivalent, really, of being a monk or being a nun. Vows of celibacy, vows of simplicity, vows of renunciation. But the ritual of it, it's actually something into which one gets ordained by the guru. It's not like you just wake up one day and say, okay, I'm going to be a sannyasi. You could certainly wake up and say, I'm going to abide by that. You could wake up and say, I'm going to live by this. I'm going to follow this path. But in order to actually be a sannyasi, there's actually a very, very specific rite of initiation. It's very much like a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah or a communion or any sort of religious ceremony that we have that has a very deep meaning for the individual, but also has a very specific system in which it takes place. And the religious authority, whether it's the rabbi, whether it's the minister, whether it's the priest, or in this case, it's the guru, who bestows sannyas. It's a very elaborate rite of passage. But the important parts are really what it symbolizes. And as I said, what it symbolizes is a renunciation of the stuff that most people tend to live for. Sensual pleasures and accumulation of material goods. And so by taking sannyas, what it's saying is, well, okay, that's out. It's not just celibacy as in no sex, but it's also no family. It's no material possessions as in a house or this or that. But what sannyas is, to me, is more interesting than what it's not. So what we have vowed against. So, as I said, vows of celibacy, vows of simplicity, vows of renunciation. That's the what you give up. But to me, what's more interesting is what you get. What sannyas is about becoming or attaining rather than what it's about relinquishing.
And really what it is it's not against sex because sex is bad, or against families because families are bad, or against possessions because possessions are bad, and that somehow not having these things is higher than having them. It's not that. It's relinquishing that, because that's what tends to distract us from our spiritual practice. If I'm focused on, did my kid take her sweater to school? Is my husband, did he make his lunch before he walked out the door? Oh, you know, what's going to happen? She's got an exam today. Or, you know, oh my God, he's having lunch with that pretty new secretary today. You know, if you start having these sorts of thoughts and concerns, this is the stuff that disrupts meditation. So here I am sitting to meditate, and my mind is wondering about the pretty new secretary my husband's having lunch with, or how my kid is going to do on an exam, or did they remember to take their sweater, or all of the stuff that being in a family is full of. Not that it's bad, not that it's wrong by any means. And in fact, the scriptures and the teachings are full of stories and emphases on enlightened people, great sages and rishis who were family people, who were married, who had children. But the path of sannyas is a path of spiritual practice above all else. The path of being a householder is really spiritual practice through all else. So how can my marriage, how can my job, how can my family be a way for me to have a spiritual practice? Not how can it be separate, that, yeah, I've got this really peaceful half an hour in the morning, and then the kids wake up. Or I've got this really beautiful prayer time in the morning, and then my husband wakes up. Not that. But how can that marriage, how can that family be my spiritual practice? But sannyas is a different path. It's a path that says spiritual practice above all else. So anything that's going to distract me, thwart me, pull me out of that. If I have possessions, I'm worried about losing them. I'm worried about somebody stealing them. If I own things, I'm worried about something happening to them. Whether it's a literal possession of, you know, some jewelry or something, you know, something I might have, or whether it's my money sitting in the stock market. I'm worried, is it going to fall overnight? So suddenly my attention, instead of being on spiritual awakening, is on, oh my God, what happens if the stock market crashes? Oh my God, what happens if there's an earthquake and my house falls? Oh my God, what happens if my child fails her chemistry exam today? What happens if my husband does have lunch with that pretty secretary? And, you know, so I get distracted. So in order to fully immerse in spiritual practice, we remove the rest. So that's what the path of sannyas is. But one last and really important part of that, because people tend to talk a lot about detachment. There's a Sanskrit word, vairagya, which is translated typically as non-attachment or detachment. And it's seen as this great spiritual virtue, and it's associated typically with those who have taken sannyas. We are unattached to things because we've renounced them anyway. But even for people who are not sannyasis, this concept of non-attachment is one that's almost drilled into our head, thou shalt be non-attached, thou shalt be non-attached. And it seems to me, from what I've seen in my own life and what I've learned and what I've absorbed, is that it's a slight misconception. The non-attachment is not non-attachment to the world. In the Bhagavad Gita,
Lord Krishna explains very, very beautifully, very clearly, and very emphatically how we need to be not attached to the fruits of our labor. I study for an exam, I do my best, I go in, I take it. Now, whether the teacher decides to mark me with a good grade or a bad grade, it's out of my hands. I know I have done my job sincerely. I've really done the best I can. Do I get an A? Do I get a C? Do I fail? I'm not going to be attached to that. I put a lot of time and energy into a project that I believe in. I do my due diligence. I do the work. I do it with sincerity. Is it going to be something that's adopted and, you know, make me a billionaire? Or is it going to be something that's going to sit gathering dust on somebody's table for the next 3 decades? That's not in my hands. And the more I'm attached to the fruits of my labor, the more frustrated and depressed and disappointed we get. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna emphasizes this non-attachment, not to the world, but to the fruits of our labors, of our labor. So that's aspect one of this non-attachment concept. The other aspect is in general spiritual practice of, oh, you shouldn't be attached to this, you shouldn't be attached to these people, you shouldn't be attached at all. And you start to see almost a condoning or even a revering of indifference, of apathy. And that's not at all what the teachings are. So taking sannyas does not mean that we do our best to be as indifferent as we possibly can, or do our best to be as apathetic as we possibly can, or do our best to be as disconnected from the world as we possibly can. What it is that instead of having one family, one husband, one wife, a couple kids, a couple in-laws, so that all of my attention is focused on one or two or three people. Instead of that, the world becomes my family. So that's a really important difference. It's not I've gone from caring about five to caring about none. To I've gone from caring about five to I've gone to caring about 5 billion or 7 billion if I can get there. So when we talk about renunciation, it's not a removal, a separation, a cutting off from, yeah, historically, people will go off into the mountains, live in a cave for a while. You hear a lot of stories. Puja Swamiji lived in the jungles for almost a decade. But that's a charging of the battery, you can say. In all of these stories, they come back full of fire to serve and to help. And Puja Swamiji always speaks about, you know, the Buddha goes out, sits under the Bodhi tree, gets his enlightenment, but then doesn't go deeper into the forest. Rather, he comes back now to serve. And so that for me is always a really important distinction, is that the renunciation is a renunciation of this very small nuclear circle of care into a much more global circle of care. It's not a renunciation of care. It's not a detachment from caring. And for me, because I'm a scientist at heart, I learn things still very much by a sort of scientific method. This is what I've seen in the most enlightened masters I've met. They're the least detached, disinterested, apathetic, aloof, disconnected, uncaring. Rather, they're the most connected, most caring, most compassionate, most loving. All of them. And so that's when you realize, oh, wait. That's actually the highest goal. It's not cutting myself off, rather it's expanding the circle. And then in terms of the concept of guru and how to explain it, everybody in this world, pretty much, particularly everybody in the Western world, the metropolitan, modern, sophisticated world. I mean, we're not talking about people who are living in villages, because in many cases, although they have much less, they're actually much better off emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. But people who have everything, almost everyone, is really deeply looking for something, looking for happiness in some way, looking for peace in some way, looking for fulfillment in some way. And we go from the most shallow level to the, if I just could lose 10 pounds, then everything would be okay, to a deeper level. If I just could find my purpose in life, if I just could meditate more deeply. If I, you know, so it spans the whole spectrum from really superficial to much deeper. But nonetheless, everyone is still in a place of feeling like there's something that still stands between me and the peace I'm searching for, the love I'm searching for, the joy I'm searching for. And the guru is really the one who brings that to you. And the truth is, you know, we call it a guru. So you're going to go around and say, my guru. Your friends will be like, what's that? But every one of them, depending on what it is that's between them and happiness or them in peace or them in fulfillment, has some place, or in many cases, many places they go to try to bridge that chasm, to try to bring what they're looking for into their hands. Again, from the most superficial level of whether it's a gym or a bar or a disco or a brothel, to a yoga class, to a meditation class, to an astrologer. I mean, everybody does something to try to bring closer to them that which they're looking for. And the beautiful thing of having a guru is that regardless of what we're looking for, the guru is going to bring it all there. So for them, they've got to go one place to lose the weight, another place to, you know, dance off their stress, another place to have someone read their palm and tell them, you know, what to major in college, another place to learn yoga, another place for this, another person to tell them that, another person to tell this, another one to get advice from over here, another one over there. And with a guru, it's like, you know, one-stop shopping. Whatever's wrong, whatever it is we're yearning for, it's not that the guru, as I always say, it's not that the guru is a vending machine. It's not that you're going to go and say, I want to lose 10 pounds, and the guru is going to say, poof, done. But ultimately, all of that which we want it for one very, very simple reason, which is it's going to make me happy. If you actually dissect everything that we think we want in the world, and you take yourself layer by layer of why you want it, well, okay, well, so then this, why? Well, so then this, why? Then this, why?
it all eventually brings us down to then I would feel happy. I want to lose 10 pounds. Why? Well, then the guy in the office next to me would, you know, look at me. Okay, well, that would make me happy. Why? Because then maybe I finally would have a date on Saturday night. Okay, and that would make me happy. Why? Because then I wouldn't be so lonely. And okay, that would make me happy. Why? Because then I would feel more like I existed. And that would make me happy. Why? Because then this hole in the pit of my stomach wouldn't be there. Okay, and that would make me happy. Why? You see, and so you can start at the most superficial of what we think we want. And ultimately it all comes down to, well, that's, I want it because it's going to make me happy. And if we take ourselves even deeper, the happiness takes the form of fullness, enoughness. Well, if I have that, then it would be enough. And whether it's a possession, whether it's a title, whether it's a relationship, all of it becomes about, because then I would be happy. Why? Because then it would feel like enough. I would feel like enough. That little voice in my head that said, you're not enough, would finally shut up. When I compared myself to people around me, I would no longer feel less than. When I compared myself to who I thought I should be, I would no longer feel like a failure. And each of us has, you know, something different, but it's all about, ultimately, whatever I think I want, it's for the happiness, so I feel like enough. I am enough, I have enough, it is enough. And the thing with the guru is, it's not, okay, poof, here's your 10 pounds, poof, here's your, you know, condo in Hawaii. It's, poof, here's your enoughness. Poof, here's your peace, here's your joy. And so suddenly all of those things that we thought we needed no longer are required. Doesn't mean they're not nice. Doesn't mean that we don't still work for them. But they no longer stand between me and happiness. They no longer stand between me and enoughness. And so what I would say to friends who ask is, all of the things that I'm yearning for in my life, he's the one who brings them to me. And whether you're religious or not religious, doesn't get much better than that. I mean, we all would love, you know, the equivalent of a drive-through for things other than dinner. And that's really, really the role that the guru plays for us. And it's not always easy, of course. You know, I frequently share the analogy that being with the guru feels very much like being the clay on the spinning wheel of the potter, where, yeah, you get whacked with every turn. And you get dizzy. And then after you've been whacked a bunch, you get thrown in the fire. But ultimately, it's all in the service of taking a lump of clay and turning it into something that's both beautiful and ultimately of some use to someone, whether it's a bowl, whether it's a teacup, whether it's a flower vase, you know, whatever the artist was making. Well, he took that lump of clay and has turned it into something that's exquisite and beneficial, useful to the world. And that's what the guru does for us. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week, and I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on OM Times Radio.